We don't have a vaccine for this one, and we probably won't for at least a year.
New updates on the spread of the Wuhan coronavirus, and they aren't good. It's Friday, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also coming up, growing xenophobia about Chinese tourists. The Oscars face a diversity test yet again. And making art from ice. It's all coming up on today's VOA Asia. The World Health Organization isn't yet calling the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic, although some infectious disease experts are saying that it could lead to one. The virus has spread to more than two dozen countries, although the vast majority of cases and deaths have been in China. VOA asked experts experienced on disease outbreaks what they would do to stop this one.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention helped West African countries successfully end their Ebola outbreak a few years ago. At the time, the CDC was headed by Dr. Tom Frieden. He now heads a global nonprofit organization called Resolve to Save Lives. In a Skype interview, VOA asked him, how do you end the coronavirus epidemic going on now?
For each different microbe, we have a different approach. For some, we have vaccines. For some, there are containment measures like SARS or MERS or Ebola, where we can actually stop it. And for some, like flu, we try to mitigate. We try to reduce the damage.
With Ebola, finding people who have had contact with those infected is critical. Ebola spreads through bodily fluids. Contact has to be close. Coronaviruses are airborne, like measles, which means that these viruses can spread more easily through coughing or sneezing. This makes contact tracing much more difficult. Isolation is also key.
Don't go out if you're sick.
But with a widespread virus that has infected more than 20,000 people, that can be a daunting task. Lauren Sauer, director of the Office of Critical Event Preparedness and Response at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore, spoke to VOA by Skype.
It's hard. It's definitely a really challenging public health question.
The Chinese government has asked people to self-isolate if they don't need hospital care. The government has also quarantined entire cities, which means people who are there are not allowed to leave. Frieden explains.
In public health terms, we call something social distancing. In other words, reducing the amount of contact among people.
There are other things public health experts recommend repeatedly.
Wash your hands, cover your cough.
Everyone needs to wash their hands. Everyone needs to stay home if they're sick.
We don't have a vaccine for this one, and we probably won't for at least a year.
Researchers are working on a vaccine. But for this virus, the public health practices will likely end the outbreak, whether it reaches pandemic stage or not. It's what ended the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and some other epidemics as well. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you can read much more on this top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, or visiting the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. China says it will cut tariffs on $75 billion of U.S. imports. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani laid the foundation stone for building a key transmission line linking Central Asia and South Asia. The Philippine Foreign Secretary warned Thursday that abrogating a security accord with Washington would undermine his country's security. Death toll stemming from the coronavirus in China continued to rise Thursday as authorities reportedly were ordered to round up all infected city residents of Wuhan. You can read and watch much more at VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, as well as our website, voanews.com. And VOA Asia continues. Rising numbers of coronavirus in China are leading to growing reports of xenophobia and racist incidents against Chinese and Asian immigrants. Customers from mainland China have reportedly been banned from businesses in parts of Asia and in the United States. One incident in Washington state recounts that a Costco worker told a Chinese child wearing a face mask to move away out of fear of infection. Restaurants in Japan, Hong Kong, South Korea, and Vietnam have reportedly refused to serve Chinese patrons. And in Indonesia, protesters marched on a hotel and called for Chinese guests to leave, among other incidents around the world. Greg Orton is the national director of the National Council of Asian Pacific Americans. He told our Ira Melman that the reports of racism are troubling.
We are monitoring sort of what is occurring around the United States and have certainly taken notice of what's happened around the world and have to say it's disappointing. But, you know, I think it's important to note that as of right now, there's only a handful of cases here in the United States. And so we want to remind people that while this is a significant, you know, public health concern and we want to take it seriously, that defaulting to racism is never the right thing to do.
Well, let me take one instance, and that's what happened at UC Berkeley, the University of California in Berkeley. They put out a message about these issues, acknowledging that feelings of xenophobia were a common reaction to fear of disease. The university got backlash for acknowledging what many experts say is a scientific fact, and then retracted the statement and went on to say simply acknowledging that xenophobia has been adaptive in the past is not the same as endorsing or defending racism. How delicate is that line?
I think it's a very fine line, to be completely honest. Again, this is a very legitimate public health concern, and everyone should take it seriously. But we don't, you know, mass hysteria never made a situation better. And I think what happened in Berkeley was certainly unfortunate, but I think the university handled it the correct way in terms of retracting that the information that they had put out originally.
This broadcast is headed basically to English speakers throughout Asia. What can you tell them about what is happening? Well, not only in their rest of the world, but in their country as well, from as we understand it.
Well, I can speak from the Asian American perspective, and I think, you know, this is a tough one because for many Asian Americans here, at least in the United States, the perception of being the perpetual foreigner is constant for us, and so you can spend your entire life here in the United States, born and raised, and suddenly you're sick now and you're perceived as someone who could have the coronavirus, and that's rather ridiculous, but it is the reality of things. And so that's why we're doing our best to remind people to, again, not default to racism, especially during these, you know, these times in which there's this heightened concern about the virus. As far as, you know, Asians around the world, it certainly we'll continue to monitor what's happening, and I think it is concerning because, you know, in many ways, what we've already seen is pretty disappointing as far as the reaction of many in relation to the coronavirus.
What is your explanation of the difference between xenophobia and racism?
You know, in many ways, I would say there's not much difference. I think xenophobia is, you know, perhaps more of an academic way of looking at things in terms of a reaction of a population of people in a certain country. But at the end of the day, at least my opinion, is that they're rooted in the same thing, which is being misinformed or allowing stereotypes to drive perception of reality. And those are things that we all have to work on being better at.
Greg Orton is National Director of the National Council of Asian Pacific Americans. He spoke with VOA's Ira Melman. Happening now in Asia, Prime Minister Narendra Modi said Thursday that Indian Muslims had nothing to fear from a new citizenship law. Modi said Congress and other opposition parties had incited nationwide protests against the law, which fast-tracks naturalization for Hindus, Christians, and other religious minorities. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues from Washington. Poor villagers in remote Cambodian provinces commonly occupy public lands, hoping to be later granted legal ownership by the authorities. Hundreds of cases in the past have been decided in their favor, but a recent land protest has resulted in a clash with local military police that killed one of the villagers. The outcry that followed prompted Cambodia's president to order an investigation, and the perpetrators face over a decade in prison. VOA's Naren Sun spoke to people directly affected by these evictions. Like hundreds of other poor villagers, Srus Toy and his wife Kimlak Boy had settled on what they thought was public land, hoping the authorities would grant them ownership of it. Toy's wife Boy.
Because of the poverty, we asked the government for the land. Following others, we went and occupied the land. My husband just followed everyone else.
The 34-year-old, along with land protesters, were arrested and accused of illegally occupying privately owned lands in Bante Munche, a western province near the Thai border. He was taken into custody in late December and died on January 1st. Official reports say his death was due to sickness and alcoholism, but his family disagrees. They allege he was beaten by two military policemen.
I saw the bruises. When my husband left home, he was fine. He was healthy like others. But there were several bruises on his dead body and face. I admitted my husband could drink, but he was not an alcoholic.
After the arrest, Srus Toy was repeatedly brutally beaten inside the military police headquarters on December 28. Ron An, a fellow prisoner, survived the incident.
The guard said that Srus Toy screamed and ran awkwardly. The police chief ordered, beat him to death, and I will take care of it.
Police violence in land disputes has occurred more frequently in the last decade as land price has skyrocketed amidst the country's surging development. The government openly admits failure in resolving land disputes. Prime Minister Hun Sen, who was made aware of the torture and death, ordered a swift investigation. 4 days later, two military policemen were arrested and charged over intentional violence and death. They can face up to 15 years in prison. The four surviving victims were released and placed under court's supervision. They're now calling for a complete drop of private ownership violation against them. Boy was given $3,000 by an anonymous source for her husband's funeral.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news alert from VOA Asia, an aggressive campaign by American authorities to root out Chinese espionage operations in the U.S. has snared a growing group of Chinese government officials, business people, and academics pursuing American secrets. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. The rights group Human Rights Watch charges that China is developing a mass surveillance system to monitor and control its population. China figures prominently in the agency's annual human rights report, which measures civilian liberties and freedoms in more than 90 nations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The advocacy group's report says the Chinese people are living through the most intense period of repression since the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square in 1989. It says the Uyghurs in the northwestern region of Xinjiang province are most victimized. It says more than 1 million people are interned in so-called re-education camps in an effort to erase their Muslim heritage and culture, a claim China denies. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says China is establishing a surveillance system unlike any ever seen before. He says that system is mostly used to keep tabs on the movements of the Uyghurs. He says the system is being developed throughout the country.
This massive database is then used to determine who is detained or not. And police officers on the street have access to that database through their handheld devices. So people stopped at checkpoints can be sent off to detention. People's homes actually have barcodes on them so that the police can quickly figure out, you know, how reliable the residents of this home are.
Roth says China censors all criticism at home and is now using its economic power to globalize its censorship system. He says the government is using its ability to control exports to the Chinese market, which represents 16% of the global economy, to get companies abroad to do its bidding.
They've used that threat of denying access to force companies to start to censor their employees. In other words, it has begun to export its censorship system to move the well-established domestic system of censorship abroad and to apply it to people anywhere in the world who might criticize China.
One of the most notorious cases concerns the U.S. National Basketball Association. China threatened to rip up a $1 billion television contract because of a dispute with the NBA over Hong Kong. Roth says China also uses its influence as a superpower to undermine initiatives it does not like on the diplomatic level. He says China uses its veto power in the United Nations Security Council to stop the UN from addressing dire situations in places such as Syria, Myanmar, and Venezuela. He accuses Beijing of doing whatever it can to undermine UN efforts to enforce human rights. He says China does respond to pressure. Countries have shown when they band together, they can successfully defy China. Roth says China cannot retaliate against all countries because it cannot afford to cut off economic relations with the entire world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news break from VOA Asia. As concerns about China's virus outbreak spread, universities around the world are scrambling to assess the risks to their programs and students, and some are canceling study abroad opportunities. Visit VOA Asia on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, only two of the 20 actors and actresses nominated for an Oscar this year are minorities, and no women were nominated in the Best Director category. Upon announcing the Oscar nominations, actress Issa Rae made a point of that by remarking, "Congratulations to those men." But why is there a lack of female and minority representation 4 years after the Academy announced it would strive for greater diversity? VOA's Penelope Pulu has the story.
Despite the Academy's unanimous vote 4 years ago to double the number of women and diverse members of the Academy by 2020, for a fourth year in a row, no female director has received a nomination in the category of Best Director.
Don't you tell me what I can't do.
Cynthia Erivo was the only non-white actor to receive a nomination for Best Performance for Harriet. Others, such as Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers, Lupita Nyong'o in Us, and Eddie Murphy in Dolomite Is My Name, were excluded. The reason behind this setback?
The percentages are still like overwhelmingly white and male, right? I think it's like 64% male and 84% white.
Cynthia Fuchs is Associate Director of Film and Video Studies at George Mason University. She says the Academy is making strides, but not fast enough. It's a long-time issue in Hollywood, a money-making machine, reluctant to invest in films about minorities and women. But Fuchs points to box office successes like Black Panther and Get Out, featuring an extensive black cast, and Bong Joon-ho's South Korean film Parasite, which received 6 Oscar nominations this year.
most people around the world actually think it is the best picture.
Fuchs says nominees are often Hollywood insiders who can afford extensive advertising campaigns, such as filmmaker Martin Scorsese, nominated for The Irishman, and Quentin Tarantino for his Hollywood nostalgia, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Many of these insiders have gained momentum from the buzz generated by receiving coveted awards before the Oscars, such as the BAFTAs, SAG Awards, Golden Globes, and Critics' Choice Awards. Money-making films such as Todd Phillips' billion-dollar box office hit, Joker, will be more on people's radar than a small independent film, says Fuchs. And while the Academy is slowly warming up to minorities and women, it may be too little too late, as younger generations are tuning out, leading to lackluster Oscars ratings, says Richard Craig, media expert at George Mason University.
I think they're just going in a different avenue, so I think the academies are going to shift. Maybe we'll see more streaming in regards to categories or something of that nature, but I don't know yet.
Cynthia Fuchs agrees. More and more streaming companies are producing and showcasing diverse, smaller films, allowing their subscribers, for a relatively small monthly fee, access to film work from all over the world, and all that from the comfort of one's couch or anywhere, really, using mobile technology.
People watch movies in a variety of ways now, and people who make movies watch movies in a variety of ways now. Not everybody goes to the theater. So Netflix is aware of that, Amazon Prime is aware of that, Hulu is aware of that, Disney is aware of that, everybody is aware of that.
Fuchs says as more and more movies are being produced outside the Hollywood system, Hollywood's traditional role as the epicenter of the film industry could be waning, and so could the Oscars if they don't reform soon enough. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
In Leesburg, Virginia, it's well above freezing, but that hasn't stopped scores of artists and carvers who come each year during the winter to turn ice into magic. VOA's Maxim Moskalkov has more.
Fantastic beasts, aliens, Star Wars characters, and frightening-looking predators. These ice carvings amaze and impress. But residents of the town of Leesburg, Virginia, are used to such sights during the annual Ice Sculpture Festival. Hundreds of tourists come every winter to see the sculptures.
So with that, we have live-action ice carving competition going on and fun little festival pieces such as interactive ice games and the ice slide. The community loves it. It's a really great opportunity for them to see something that they might not see on a normal day, come out and watch blocks of ice be transformed into these amazing sculptures.
Ice is impossible to handle with bare hands, so all carvers wear gloves and use special tools that include small axes, electric drills, chisels, power sanders, and even regular irons that practically glue pieces of ice together.
Everybody's favorite tool is the chainsaw for some reason. I pick it up, every dad wants to do it.
Glenn Hughes is from Atlanta, Georgia. For him, ice carving is not just a fun hobby, but a serious business and the main way to make a living.
I'm a full-time ice carver. I own one of the largest warehouses and ice companies in the Southeast. So this is a full-time job.
Todd Dawson came to Leesburg from North Carolina. He has been in the ice carving business for over two decades. He says he enjoys the impermanence of ice sculpture.
You plan it, you design it, you create it, and it's gone. And it's like I've done a wood carving before, and I still have it. And I see every flaw of it. I see everything I did wrong, because it's permanent. This, you know, having fun is designing it, creating it. You see it, and then boom, it's gone.
In everyday life, Rich Daly from New York is a chef, but his true passion is ice carving. His intricate ice work helped him make his way into the Guinness Book of Records. In just 2 hours and 52 minutes, he managed to create 60 sculptures out of 8,165 kilograms of ice.
Today I'm creating an extra large alien kind of bug. Kind of like a praying mantis, but it's a little bit bigger and, well, a little meaner. I left my original design on my dining room table in New York, so I'm doing this all freehand out of my mind.
Carvers work on their masterpieces all day, from 9 in the morning to 5 in the evening. In a few days, their works will melt Halloween. Away, like horror movies. But their creators won't notice. They'll be busy creating something new. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Leesburg, Virginia.
And that's VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again on Monday.